Good evening and welcome to Outbeat Collage Out in the Arts. I'm Mark Prowl alongside Gary Carnevale. Tonight we have an exciting evening of interviews with local writers. If you're not familiar with them, Google them, Amazon, they're all there. We'll speak with Kim Fassera, an author and humorist. We'll talk about both her previous book and her work in progress. That'll be in the second half of the show. And first we'll chat with Hollywood biographer Scott O'Brien about his biography of actress Anne Harding. Let you know about what's happening with the Outbeat Collage and Arts and Entertainment calendar. But first, here's Greg Moralia with Outbeat News.
This is Greg Moralia with your Outbeat Radio News for Sunday, November 21st, 2010. Two Brazilian soldiers are being held in connection with the shooting of a young gay man after the Pride Parade in Rio de Janeiro last Sunday. According to the Associated Press, an army statement says that one of the suspects acknowledged shooting 19-year-old student Douglas Igor Marquez Luiz. The two sergeants were arrested Thursday and will be questioned by police. Luiz was shot once in the stomach and treated and released by the hospital. The victim said that the soldiers singled him out and harassed him, according to the Associated Press. Votes are still being counted to determine who will be California's next attorney general. As of Friday afternoon, San Francisco District Attorney Kamala Harris held a 0.5% lead over L.A. County District Attorney Stephen Cooley. Kamala Harris said during her campaign that as attorney general, she would not defend Proposition 8, whereas Stephen Cooley vowed that he would defend Proposition 8 as the case moves through the federal court system. And the Ninth Circuit Court of Appeals will hear oral arguments on the appeal of Judge Walker's decision about Proposition 8 coming up on December 6th. This week, the Federal Appeals Court ruled that it will allow the hearing to be broadcast on C-SPAN and video recorded by several local Bay Area television stations. A panel of three judges will consider if the appellants have any kind of legal standing in the case, as well as if Judge Walker's ruling on Proposition 8 is consistent with the 14th Amendment of the United States Constitution. Yesterday was the 12th annual Transgender Day of Remembrance. Here in Santa Rosa, community members gathered at the courthouse square, despite the stormy weather, to remember those of the transgender community who have been murdered or committed suicide. This year, 12 members of the trans community have been reported to have been murdered here in the United States. Earlier this week, the Montgomery High School Gay-Straight Alliance reported that a Montgomery High School student was attacked while he walked through the Montgomery Village Shopping Center. This student was wearing a pink wristband and was apparently perceived by his attackers to be gay. Last Friday, members of the High School Gay-Straight Alliance, which includes LGBT students and their straight allies, gathered to make more pink wristbands to be worn in support of this student. The group urged friends, teachers, and family to talk about the impact of hate on the community and about ways we can all work together to prevent hate crimes like this one. And this week we begin a new segment on the news we call the Community Calendar. On Monday, November 22nd from 5 to 7 p.m., Marin's Men's Mixer will happen at the Four Point Sheraton, located at 1010 Northgate Drive in San Rafael. The gathering happens the fourth Monday of every month for gay men and bi men. This informal mixer has a no-host bar, free hors d'oeuvres, and lots of friendly guys to enjoy and mix it up with. Contact Andy at 415-457-2487 at extension 102 for more information, or just show up. On Tuesday, November 23rd at 1:30 p.m., the Santa Rosa Senior Group will meet at the Unitarian Universalist Congregation, that's the Glacier Center, here in Santa Rosa. Join this Spectrum group for lively discussions, mutual support, sharing information, and all the while celebrating who we are. Everyone is welcome, whether you're in the closet or out. For more information, contact Gary Shepard at area code 707-583-2330 or send him an email at gary@spectrumlgbtcenter.org. Also happening Tuesday, November 23rd, it's Give Back Tuesdays at the Rainbow Cattle Company in Guerneville. The bar will donate 10% of the drink sales for the day to the Harry Litt Emergency Fund. Harry Litt, who is the founder of the Russian River Lazy Bear Weekend, suffered a debilitating stroke last month in Mexico. The cost of transporting Litt back to the U.S. cost approximately $30,000. For more information, call 707-869-0206. And on Wednesday, November 24th, from 6 to 9 p.m., Marin County Women Seeking Women will gather at Jason's, located at 300 Drake's Landing Road in Greenbrae. This informal social group meets every Wednesday, and then some, for drinks, dinner, and fun at Jason's. Beginning Tuesday, November 30th, Face2Face will offer free, confidential, and anonymous HIV testing at their office located at 873 2nd Street in Santa Rosa. They're offering oral fluid tests that use oral fluid, not saliva, that is collected from the mouth using a special collection device. Take advantage of this quick and simple test to prevent against the spread of HIV/AIDS. Testing will happen every Tuesday from 2 to 4 p.m. For additional information, call 707-544-1581. Now, if you have an event that you'd like to share with our listeners, you can tell us about it by going to our website at outbeatradio.com. For Gary Carnevale, I'm Greg Moralia. Now back to Outbeat Collage.
Scott O'Brien writes biographies, journal articles, and is a guest lecturer. Scott has long revered the joys of classic film and personalities involved in creating this unique art form. His previous books are K. Francis, I Can't Wait to Be Forgotten, and Virginia Bruce, Under My Skin. His new book, Anne Harding, Cinema's Gallant Lady, is now available in paperback. He lives here in Sonoma County with his partner, Outbeat Radio's own Joe Bellagio. Welcome to Outbeat Collage, Scott.
It's great to be here, Gary.
Tell our audience about what an interesting performer and person Anne Harding was.
Well, she was different from the other two biographers. I mean, the biographies, the subject, anyway. She had a background in repertory theater. And she did her studies in a repertory company in Rose Valley, Pennsylvania, called Hedgerow. And Jasper Dieter, who was her mentor, the tradition of repertory theater is to create an experience for an audience to transcend their usual life and become enveloped in another person's experience, a story. And that's it isn't about being a star or anything like that. And so she had that for her background. And when she got to Hollywood, it was just the opposite. They tried to make this big star out of her. But mm-hmm. She was so charmed by the climate and the money that she stuck to it for a few years. And she was RKO's top star for about a 2 to 3 year period before Katharine Hepburn came in.
And she really took acting seriously. I mean, she was really involved in the process. Not that other actors at that time weren't, but... In your book, you sort of touch on the fact that some people had a problem with the way that, she was a perfectionist. She really wanted to shape that character, and she really wanted to take the time to give the best performance she could.
Right. It wasn't about, it wasn't about her. It was about the story. And a lot of times she'd make suggestions to the director, hey, let's build up this person's part. The studios, they were interested in creating stars, and so they would build up her part, and she would go home and say, "No, we're not doing that."
Yeah, she was tough.
Yeah,
she was really tough. And she started in films at a pretty difficult time when they were just making the transition to talkies. Talk about the difficulties encountered during the production of early sound films.
Right. Well, yeah, 1929, the sound equipment was still being developed. They were placing mics and flower pots and things like that. But she had a voice that registered in a very unique way and was very appealing. I know some of the studios, they would test their silent stars' voices, right. And, were they okay for sound? But a lot of Broadway stars, that's when there was an influx of Broadway stars coming to Hollywood. Katharine Hepburn, Jimmy Cagney, Sylvia Sidney, Kay Francis, who was also from the Broadway stage. Mm.
And there were a number of silent film stars that didn't make the transition, either because of heavy accents or just
right.
voices that didn't work.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. So, talk about Anne's sort of transition from Broadway to Hollywood.
Well, she wasn't even thinking about coming to Hollywood, but her husband was on tour in Strange Interlude, Eugene O'Neill's Strange Interlude, headed west. And so she thought she'd come out there to California with her daughter and get some sunshine before he got there. And she was so charmed by it. And there was a friend of hers from Broadway, who was working at Pathé Studios, which eventually merged with RKO, and he said, why don't you do a screen test? And so as a lark, she did the screen test, and they offered her this lucrative contract.
Which she probably thought great in the beginning, but then, like so many actresses, she's sort of started to have some battles with her studio.
Well, it was a new medium, an opportunity to work with something different, and she had enthusiasm for it. But when she saw the compromises involved, and all of a sudden she realized that she was creating this phenomenon known as the celebrity, she didn't like that because she felt it took the illusion of way away from being an actor.
And she was interested in really becoming the character, and she didn't want people to look at her as, like you said, as an actress, as a commodity. That she wanted an audience to just sort of forget about Anne Harding and see her character.
Yeah, even on Broadway, she was starring in some production early on in her career, and the marquee outside had Anne Harding. She insisted they go take it down. She says, "No, they're coming to see a play. They're not coming to see me."
And she really respected writers coming from the theater, and I mean, of course, there were a lot of interesting writers in Hollywood at that time making the transition.
Oh yeah, she particularly liked one who was married and had an affair with him, Gene Fowler, who wrote the biography on John Barrymore, and in fact, she almost came close to losing her life in a little episode trying to meet him in Cuba, and. I didn't know any of this when I started writing the book.
Oh, you didn't?
No, in fact, I didn't. It wasn't mentioned in any of the magazines at the time. Hmm. It was I had to really dig in to some newspaper archives to find out about it.
Well, your book gives great insight to the publicity machine and how stars really needed to interact with journalists. And I think in Anne's case, she grew to resent that. Was that your take on it? That she was sort of friendly and had co-starred with a few of the gossip columnists. And in certain points, you know, like when she was going through her divorce or when she was rumored about getting remarried, she would get sort of brittle with them and say, I'll announce it when I'm ready to get ready, when I'm ready to make an announcement, and I don't want people to...
Well, she got a new agent, Harry Eddington, and Harry Eddington was the agent for Greta Garbo, and he believed in this idea of inverse publicity, which means you don't say anything to the press. You just kind of disappear after you film and you go home, and it creates this mystique. Well, it worked for Garbo. It didn't work for her. And a lot of news people thought she was just being, you know, stuck up and not cooperating with them. They had to make a living. And so it was a big mistake for her. In the end, that's one of the things that ruined her in Hollywood, was her lack of cooperation with the press.
Right.
This was after her divorce.
Right. Anne sort of went from stage to motion pictures to radio work to TV and back to stage, back to motion pictures. So she was a true actress in that sense, where she can work in these different mediums and sort of bring previous experiences with her to new mediums.
Yeah, well, I think most all the stars worked in all the mediums at that time, because the radio work, when their careers started to go downhill, they went into radio, or sometimes there were certain radio shows like Hollywood Hotel, where they would do scenes from their latest movie.
Metro films, yeah.
And then, of course, when TV came on, a lot of the stars who were popular in the 30s, that was an opportunity to keep their career going. And her first love was the theater, so she went back. The Corn is Green, the role of Miss Moffat in The Corn is Green was one of her favorites. She even tackled Tennessee Williams, The Glass Menagerie, and Suddenly Last Summer. I guess she...
Which was interesting. I had no idea that it Suddenly Last Summer was really a one-act play.
Two one-act plays called The Garden District. The first one, both of them had the gay undercurrent. The first were about two women who lived together who had had a sexual experience that they didn't want to talk about. Mm-hmm. And then the second one was the Suddenly Last Summer with Sebastian and the mother who wanted his friend to have the lobotomy, his lady friend.
In the 50s was a film starring...
Yeah, Catherine Hepburn.
Montgomery Clift.
And Anne Harding's rival, Catherine Hepburn.
Right. Yeah. And you touched on that. And you don't seem a big fan of Catherine Hepburn. You don't seem to be... Was I reading between the lines?
Well, part of it is, I mean, I like Catherine Hepburn. When I was young and I started watching old movies, mm-hmm. I liked the actresses that overplayed, like Bette Davis and Catherine Hepburn.
Yeah, yeah.
They were bigger in life.
Right.
And then as I got older, I tuned into these women who were more subtle, more natural. Mm. I love Catherine Hepburn and Alice Adams. What was the other...
Bringing Up Baby is one of my favorite mm-hmm. films. I mean, she's
Queen.
So young in that.
The African
but,
Queen.
Right. Yeah. Anne Harding was really a bigger star than Katharine Hepburn until sort of Anne's career sort of faded.
Yeah, she was the top star at RKO from 29 to like 34. And Irene Dunne was in there too, but Anne was bigger box office.
And she was making really good money.
Yeah.
For that time.
Yeah.
$4,000-$6,000 a week.
Mm-hmm.
But also produced, it was in many films. I mean, at one point, I think you wrote she had been in 4 films in 7 months. She had filmed 4 films in 7 months.
Right. Well, of course, you know, there was a lot of, like at Warner Brothers, some of the co-stars could do, you know, 15, 20 films a year.
Yeah. Incredible.
Yeah.
Incredible. I mean, especially as a lead actress, mm-hmm. you know, a bit part is sort of one thing. But
right.
Wow, that's really taxing.
And they weren't always the best vehicles.
Right, you know,
stories for her were a real problem. Now, she had the opportunity to do F Human Bondage.
Hmm.
Leslie Howard wanted her. That was his favorite co-star, and he was her favorite leading man. And she kind of balked at playing a prostitute, as did Katharine Hepburn.
Hmm.
Because after Anne rejected it, it went to Katharine Hepburn. Hmm. And it was Anne's misfortune. She didn't grab a hold of it because look what happened. It really,
really launched,
turned Bette Davis's career around.
Hmm.
And Anne had played prostitutes on Broadway before, so I don't know what the problem was.
Yeah. Well, now that's a nice segue into the Hays Code.
Yeah.
So talk about the effect that it had in Hollywood and in general in Anne's career in particular.
Well, the Hays Code, the Production Code Association, went into effect in July 1934, and it was years in the making. They really clamped down, and what fueled the Production Code was the Catholic Church and the Catholic Legion of Decency, and they created all these do's and don'ts. Now, before 1934, that's why critics like Mick LaSalle in San Francisco, he wrote a whole book called Complicated Women about the pre-code films.
Mm-hmm.
And people think a lot of things that we see nowadays are new. But before the code, if you watch some of these early films, there's a real gay presence in a lot of films, mm-hmm. for one thing. But July 34, no reference could be made to gay people, right. or any, you know, pansy thing.
Interracial marriages,
right.
or unwed mothers, or, you know, things now that...
No belly buttons on screen.
Right. And so you say it's 1934, and that was sort of the end of Anne's heyday. You mm-hmm. said she was the
women
top star.
In particular had to make a lot of compromises on screen after that. You know, if there was any infidelity... they had to be punished or put in prison or killed by the end of the
Right. And even though Anne didn't really star in these sort of, you know, as a prostitute or in these racy roles, she was in what they called at the time Weepers,
mm-hmm.
but it was some chancy material.
Two of her biggest hits were she played mistresses, The Life of Virgie Winters and Gallant Lady.
Mm-hmm.
And but the way the film really opened people up, it opened up their humanity seeing these, if they were well done.
Hmm. So talk about her role in starting the Screen Actors Guild.
Screen Actors Guild, the studios really didn't want any kind of union representation in Hollywood. They really fought it. But and it was mostly second leads and players, supporting players that started it. And then Jimmy Cagney, Eddie Cantor, and Ann Harding got involved with it. She was the first big name who got involved with Screen Actors Guild. And after their first big promotion at El Capitan Theater in Hollywood, that after that evening, over 500 top name stars signed on for the Screen Actors Guild. And basically, what it was about having their rights. And the producers, the Louis B. Mayer and Zanuck and Jack Warner, of course, they were all fighting all of this.
Right.
And so she was the second vice president for about 3 years.
Because at the time, you work until we're done. Your day is as long as we tell you it is, and you're working 7 days a week or until the film is finished,
Boris Karloff had horror stories to tell about his Frankenstein, working on Frankenstein, just wearing this ungodly makeup and, for hours and hours and hours with no breaks and...
And the lights, they were talking about how intense the lights were, which you could imagine, especially when color came into play, that the lights had to be even more intense than they were.
Technicolor was a real problem. It damaged a lot of stars' eyes.
Right. So you mentioned some of her films. Which of her films were your favorites and why?
Well, there's one, Peter Ibbotson with Gary Cooper. Now, that's available on DVD in the Gary Cooper collection. And it's an old story, but beautifully performed. Has a mystical edge to it about this couple who are separated and they meet in their dreams. Mm. He's in prison, Gary Cooper's character, and he wants proof. And so in their dream state, she says, "I will send you proof tomorrow." And in the next day, he receives a ring from her, and then he knows that they are dreaming in time. Hmm. And beautifully photographed. And then The Life of Virgie Winters, which is based on a Louis Bromfield novel. Racy stuff for the time, but again, a haunting performance by Ann Harding. Holiday, she was in the first Holiday, and she's more in terms of the lead character, she comes across more like the character than Katharine Hepburn in the remake.
Mm-hmm.
Katharine Hepburn is Katharine Hepburn, but Ann Harding was more the character she was playing.
And it's amazing how quickly they remade films.
Yeah.
I was sort of taken with that. 10 years or so, they would be remaking
or
films.
Even less. Yeah, they just changed the title.
That seems so odd.
Well, the studio owned the property.
Right.
And they might as well get their money out of it, especially if it was a big hit.
And they just sort of thought they could make more money and put another star
Maltese
in
Falcon
it.
Maltese Falcon is one. Yeah.
So you wonder if they sort of had no concept of, or they didn't quite grasp how the longevity of a given film. How people would view it and say that was the perfect film for that time, and why on earth would you remake it? And because Holiday was a really popular film. I mean, it just seems so odd that less than 10 years later they would remake it.
Right, and she was nominated for Best Actress for that.
So what are you working on next? What's your next book?
I'm taking a break after doing three of those and immersing myself in the 1930s, 40s, and 50s for the last 7-8 years.
Yeah.
Actually, I'm working on a biography on my mother.
Oh, great.
For the family. And she taught at Montgomery High School here in Santa Rosa. She brought academic English to Sonoma County. She was Teacher of the Year in 1981.
Oh, wow.
And so I'm interviewing my aunts and uncles and friends that knew her. And
that's great.
Yeah.
That's great. What made you think of doing that?
She's a star.
She's your star.
I'm giving her the same treatment as Ann Harding and Kay Francis and Virginia Bruce.
Scott, great. Thank you for joining us.
Welcome.
I appreciate it.
It was a pleasure.
Much success with the book.
Okay.
And happy Thanksgiving.
All righty.
Traverse City still has visit me, claiming you have answers. Street preachers say this is your year. Staring at the peeling paint and the careless mold, wishing I shared my anger before it took its toll. I never knew fall in Michigan would make you cry so hard. Leaves turning years to discard.
Local support for Outbeat Radio this evening on KRCB-FM comes from members and from Advanced Fertility Associates Medical Group, providing comprehensive fertility care to men, women, and couples wishing to expand their families. Advanced technology, old-fashioned care. Serving Santa Rosa and the North Bay for 25 years on the web at afamd.com.
That was Danny Katz with Fall in Michigan off of his brand new CD, Japanese Satellites. Now here's Outbeat Collage out in the arts calendar of events. The Napa Valley College Criminal Justice Training Center will host a premiere showing of The Anatomy of Hate, A Dialogue to Hope, and a community discussion with the film's director and producer, Mike Ramsdell, on Thursday, December 2nd at 7 p.m. at the Napa Valley College of Performing Arts Center, 2277 Napa Vallejo Highway in Napa. Admission to this event is free, but tickets are required as seating is limited. For more information and for tickets, go to www.nvccjtc.org. It's Christmas Eve 1947 at the Rio Nido Lodge, where some of Hollywood's finest actors have gathered to broadcast a special Lux Radio Theater version of one of America's most beloved movies, It's a Wonderful Life. This is the premises of Pegasus Theater Company's holiday offering, It's a Wonderful Life, a stage radio play with music. The show will run from Friday, December 3rd through Sunday, December 19th. General admission is $15, $5 for children under 12. Fridays are pay what you can. For reservations, visit the website at pegasustheater.com or call 707-583-2343. The San Francisco Gay Men's Chorus will perform a soulful celebration, its 10th annual holiday concert benefiting Face-to-Face Sonoma County AIDS Network, on December 11th at the Center for Spiritual Living in Santa Rosa. Since 2001, the chorus has helped Face-to-Face raise $94,000 for housing assistance, benefits, counseling, emergency financial aid, emotional support, prevention, education, and in-home care for their clients in Sonoma County. They hope to raise $20,000 this year. Seats for the concerts are $20 in advance and $25 at the door. They are available from the Face-to-Face website, www.f2f.org, or by calling 707-544-1581. Now we will interview Kim Fassara, humorist and author. Kim Fassara is an author, humorist, and social media professional living in Sonoma with her better half. Kim has written one book of humorous essays, Sex, Lies, and Stereotypes, and Unconventional Life Uncensored, and has contributed to three others. She currently is writing her next book, A Humorous Ode to Her Youth. Last week, Kim launched her online store where she sells her Cork Teas merchandise. Welcome to Outbeat Collage, Kim.
Thank you very much, Gary. Glad to be here.
Great. So tell us all about Cork Teas.
Well, let's see. It all started on Twitter a few months ago, back in June, I think it was. And I was sitting with a friend at a bar at the Girl in the Fig in Sonoma. And we were trying to figure out how I could leverage my humor locally. I come from Connecticut, not sure that you know that, so living in Sonoma is quite a difference for me. So we started talking and wasn't sure if the Sonomans would get my humor. So we just started looking around the bar, and of course, everybody's drinking wine, and here I am drinking tequilas, and my friend's drinking beer. And we just sort of looked at each other and said, this is sort of interesting. Maybe I should write about wine. And it was actually his idea. He was the one who said that first. And I said, really, do you think that they would get my humor without me sounding like I'm insulting people? Or, you know, because I'm a bit sarcastic as you can tell by the name. And he was like, yeah, I think you should go for it. So I went home and I thought about it for a little while. And I was like, you know, I think I could do this. I think I have the kind of temperament and I'm likable for the most part. And I just thought it would be easy to do. So I went online, I started the Twitter account, and sure enough, I started getting all these followers. And after not even a month, Bottle Notes, the Daily Sip, covered me in their celebrity sips and said, here's somebody you need to follow. And then, of course, my followers shot up. And eventually, as things were going on, I figured, okay, I could do more with this. What if I make a T-shirt? So I printed a Cork Teas T-shirt, which your audience can't see, but I'm wearing now. And I wore it downtown, Sonoma. And I got a lot of compliments, a lot of remarks. Everybody's like, where can I get that? I was like, okay, I could do this. So I went home the next week, trademarked the name, and started printing shirts. And the website launched on Monday.
And the website is?
The website is corkteas.net. Not .com, .net.
And what can you get on the website?
Well, right now I have, I have men's T-shirts, women's tees, women's tanks, and caps. Everything is in black and white right now except for the caps. I also have in khaki. And I plan on getting wine totes and wine bags and, you know, different other T-shirts. But for now, that's where we are. We had to start out a little small, just me.
Sure.
Doing this, so I'm hoping it'll catch on, that people, you know, Christmas is coming. Hopefully people will buy the shirts and give them as gifts and wear them around, and there it is.
So have you talked to merchants about carrying the merchandise?
Not yet. That's something this week has been focused on, basically marketing it on Twitter. I also have a Facebook page, and which I, you know, point to all the time on Twitter. So if you follow me, it's at Cork Teas. So that'll be next week. Start doing that next week.
So how many people follow you on Twitter?
It's about 1,500 right now.
Wow.
Yeah, and like I said in the beginning, it took off. And I don't do that, you know, tweet me, follow me kind of thing.
Either. Right.
Some
oh.
people sign up for those. I don't do that.
Oh, gotcha.
Anybody who wants to follow me has followed me because they wanted to, not because I follow them.
Or right.
That annoys me. So... yeah, and they're great, and we have quite a relationship with one another. We're basically friends, even though we don't see each other.
Right.
And they follow me on Foursquare as well. So really good people, and I'm happy that they understand my humor and that they appreciate it. And, you know, obviously I enjoy wine. I enjoy tequila as well, but... I enjoy wine, and I really, really appreciate my followers.
So how many tweets a day do you send?
Gosh, that's a good question. On an average, 15, maybe?
A day.
Because, you know, being on Twitter, one of the things is you don't want to make a pain in the neck out of yourself either.
Right.
You don't want to, you know, I'm eating a tuna fish sandwich tweet. Mm-hmm. You want to tweet. My whole thing is just being funny and making fun of winos, so... I don't necessarily get into a lot of conversations with people, but I do thank them for following me, and I spend a lot of time, the bulk of my time, following others, too, and reading what they have to say.
So what would inspire a tweet?
Oh, gosh. It could be anything. I mean, some of the best stuff I have, I read off of people who offer wine tips.
Mm.
So someone might say, you know, always store your wine laying down in a cool, dry place. So I'll tweet something like, always store your wine standing up in the hottest, wettest place you can find, something like that, you know, that kind of thing. It's really just about whatever you should say, you just say the opposite. Learned that from Sarah Silverman.
Do you like Sarah Silverman?
I love Sarah.
Yeah, yeah. So yeah. What other humorists, writers do you...
David Sedaris.
Yeah.
Of course.
Yeah.
I've been... Actually, my first book, Sex, Lies, and Stereotypes, in so many reviews, I was compared to him, which I took that as a compliment.
Sure.
I actually have a letter he wrote to me by accident, which I kept, and now I'm claiming it as my own. I wrote to him and asked him to blurb my first book. And which I'm sure people do all the time.
Right, oh yeah.
So I got the letter from David Sedaris, and I open it up, and it says, you know, Dear Susan. I'm like, okay, well, I know what you mean. It's not mine, but it's mine now.
Did you get the white out?
Yeah, exactly. Exactly. Augustine Burroughs.
Yeah.
You know.
Do you read Chelsea Handler? Or
Chelsea Handler I watch, actually.
Yeah, yeah.
I haven't... Hello, Vodka, It's Me, or something, yeah. Her new book. Yeah, I've heard about it, and I've heard that it's really funny, but no, I haven't read it.
She's really funny. I watch her every night.
Yeah, she is. She is. Just love her. And I follow her on Twitter as well. If I can only get her to follow me, that would be great.
Right, right. Yeah. So how long have you been writing essays?
Since the late 90s. I started as a columnist at New Mass Media. In Connecticut, it's a chain of five alternative news weeklies. Had a column there. Also wrote a gay soap opera, one of the first gay soap operas online. And it lasted 4 years.
Oh, really?
Yes, it was called Gays of Our Lives.
Yes, I remember.
And I don't even know how many episodes, 180 episodes.
Oh, wow.
And it was so much fun. It was a lot of fun. So we took, when I say we, I had a designer I worked with. So I wrote the text, and he added, you know, back in the old days of the internet, there was no flash.
Right,
so
right.
You might have things moving, you know, but it was just great. So we took stuff from pop culture and just went wild with it. You know, George Michael's antics, and it was a lot of fun. So then from the column, I got an agent, and he's like, you need to... put this stuff in a book. I was like, really? And he's like, yeah, really. So I did it. He found me a publisher, and we did it, and it was just amazing.
Wow.
Yeah, it took a while, a couple of years from start to finish. But it was, it's one of the things I'm most proud of in my life, writing a book. Always wanted to, finally did it.
So they were all columns that you selected?
No, the deal, of course, when you have a publisher, the last thing they want to publish is things that have already been published. So I had some in the book that were from my column, and then most of it was new. Most of the content was new. Yeah.
And how long did it take you to write?
Well, like I said, from start to finish, the whole deal was about 2 years.
Yeah.
As far as writing, a year.
Mm-hmm.
Probably a year.
Right.
You know, and then you write and you rewrite.
Sure.
And I'm the kind of person that could rewrite something to the point where it sucks again.
Right. Well, especially when you're dealing with humor.
Yeah, it's hard. Yeah, yeah. It's hard. And then even if I read it, my thing is if I read it and read it and read it and it's still funny, I'm okay.
Yeah.
I feel good about it.
It doesn't feel tired or hackneyed.
No. And I mean, I have people who read the book now. I get letters. And even though the book is from 2003, so it's a bit dated, but people still tell me, this is so funny.
It's hysterical.
You read it,
Yeah. Laugh out loud, as they say.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. And that was, actually, that book got me in the Out 100. So I was very happy to be there.
Wow.
Yeah. Yeah, that was good. Me and Ellen DeGeneres.
Oh, yeah? Right up there.
So
with
if
Ellen.
You close the page, we kiss.
Or something.
Or something.
So when did you move to California?
6 years ago.
Yeah.
My wife, Tracy, got a job out here, and they moved us.
Wow.
And we've been here ever since.
Yeah. In Sonoma the whole time?
In Sonoma the whole time. Well, we started in Napa for 3 months.
Until, oh, yeah.
You know, they put us in corporate housing. And then we found a home in Sonoma that we love.
Yeah.
And we live there now.
Nice, nice. Oh, so you didn't take the usual step of San Francisco first, and then...
No, really, her job was based in Napa.
Yeah.
So it really made no sense for us to live in San Francisco. And, you know, I'm not a city girl. I lived in Boston college, and I was over it.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
Been there, done that kind of thing. And now we live close enough to San Francisco that we can go there whenever we'd like and come
back.
You
either are or you aren't, I think. Yeah, a city person.
I think I just was, and now I'm not anymore.
Right, right.
But I love it.
Yeah,
love being so close.
Mm-hmm.
Love that I have friends who live there.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
So then I could just go stay with them.
Right, right. To get your, to dip your toe in.
Exactly.
The madness. So there are some pretty racy passages in the book.
Yes.
How did family and friends respond?
Family, no problem. Friends, certainly no problem. Although it got to the point where I feed off my friends.
Right.
You know, what I write about is true. And so I was using true instances, of course, and writing about them, changing their names. So everybody would be like, you're not going to write about this, are you? You know. So I was like, yeah, probably, but don't worry about it. I'll change your name. My family's been great. My family's always been great.
Right.
Yeah.
So have you ever said it? Have you ever had anyone say, no, I don't want you to include this?
No.
Really?
No. Yeah.
That's great.
No, I mean, I've said to myself,
yeah,
this isn't going in the book.
Gotcha.
You know what I mean?
Yeah.
But no, I've not. No.
Right.
So, no. In fact, I've had people tell me, please write about me.
Oh, yeah, yeah. So what topics are taboo for you? I mean, the goal is to be funny, obviously, but is there...
Yeah, no.
No? There's no line in the sand that
no.
you
I mean, that's
draw.
A really good question.
Yeah.
I don't think I've ever really thought about it before, but I don't think so. I mean, you know, I'm also on Twitter, I'm also at Virgin Mary. So that'll tell you that there's really not too much that's taboo to me. And
right.
I obviously don't tweet, you know.
Right, right, right. So Tammy's okay with everything, too?
Tracy.
Tracy?
Yes.
Sorry.
Yeah, yeah. She's very supportive. I mean, she couldn't be more supportive.
So you can talk about her and your relationship, no problem.
Yeah.
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 That's great.
I mean, again, I go back to saying that there are things that I'll put through my own editing.
Right.
And say, okay, no, this won't work. And I don't know. I'd really have to think about that, but I don't.
Good.
I can't imagine that there's something that.
Right. Everything
I
just.
I mean,
for
I wouldn't.
The mill.
I wouldn't, that's the word I'm looking for. You can edit this out, right? I wouldn't pass rumors.
Right.
You know, or lie.
Gossip.
I wouldn't do that. Mm-hmm. That makes no sense. That's not funny. That's hurtful.
And they're your experiences. You're not really talking about
Yeah, and I'm not
else.
Going to, in fact, you've touched on a good subject that there are so many comedians today who focus on being mean to be funny. Mm-hmm. And that's not who I am. I mean, if you have to be mean to be funny, then in my mind, you're not funny.
Mm-hmm.
Be smart. Be witty.
Right.
There's no need to be mean. Yeah, I don't want to be that. I don't want to be a mean comedian.
That.
Yeah.
Don Rickles or... Yeah.
You know, Joan Rivers,
yeah.
As much as I love her, and I just saw her biopic, which I absolutely loved,
oh,
she can get a little,
good.
You know,
yeah, yeah.
A little mean. But no.
But she seems to have moved away from that a bit.
Yeah, I mean, but her thing now is she does the E
right.
style, so she sort of has to put people
yeah,
down.
Yeah, yeah.
I mean, it's her job. But I take truth, and I... Don't and I turn it around. I make it funny, and you won't believe how
easy
it is.
So there's not a whole lot of tweaking.
You just say the truth, really. When something is so obviously ridiculous, it makes for good humor. Gay marriage, for example, people get divorced every day, every day, and marriage is sacred.
Right.
Well, act like it's
people
sacred.
Are getting married in Las Vegas by Elvis impersonators.
Exactly. Let's be
in record numbers.
Exactly. Come
right.
on. This
right.
is crazy.
Right.
People are marrying. People have three wives.
Yeah.
It makes no sense. So, to twist that around and to hopefully make it funny is where you get it. Humor is a great equalizer.
Mm-hmm.
People get it. They know when they're being stupid and right. when they're not being stupid. Right. They just think they're being right. That's the danger.
Right.
They think they're right.
So talk about your new book.
Well, my new book is different. It is not a book of essays. So this is kind of new for me. It's fiction based in truth, but I'm taking some liberties. And I'm calling it an ode to my youth since I don't have a title for it yet. And it's, I just had an interesting life. My parents were awesome, great parents, love them to death. They had two children, myself and my sister Patty, but we were 15 years apart. So by the time I came along, my parents were pretty much done being parents.
Wow.
So they took great care of me, obviously, and loved me to death, but they sort of treated me like a short little boarder in their house. Like somebody just came to their door one day and said, oh, here's this little girl. Can you just watch her when I go out for milk? And they were like, okay. And then that person never came back. And there I am, living. Italian, Roman Catholic.
Mm-hmm.
Just my father was a funny guy. He grew up in Minnesota, ended up in Connecticut, and he never really took the farm out of himself. Mm. So we had half an acre of land in Connecticut. He had a huge garden and a giant tractor, as if he was going to like mow the field every day or whatever. He was also a guy who found things, quote unquote, air quotes, found things. So let's see, we have about 5,000 marbles that we didn't know where he got. He found a mini bike, however, didn't have a motor, but he brought it home to me anyway. What else? We used to go on long trips and car rides. My father was great. Let's get in the car and go somewhere, which, of course, we all had to do. So
yeah.
We get in the car and we go somewhere. And one time we're driving through, I don't know, Kansas or something like that. And there's a big tractor trailer in front of us. Mm. And all of a sudden, he loses half his load. And all these little white boxes come flying out. Yuck. Now, my father's like trying to, you know, swerve around these boxes. And finally he pulls over and we're like, what happened? You know, flat tire. And he was like, no, we're going to go get those. I was like, well, we don't even know. He's like, I don't care what's in them. So he it's makes something. Us go out, me and my mom, out and dodging traffic to pick up these boxes. So finally we get back to he always had a van. So we get back to the van, we're putting this stuff in the van, we open it up, and there are thousands of plastic bags that you put newspapers in. You know when you get your newspaper delivered?
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
They're useless for anything else. Maybe carrots, celery, I don't know what.
Oh, produce bags.
We
right.
had those bags, and he took them. We drove all over the country with those bags in the car. So we had those forever, you know. He would take us to, you know, strange places, like a toothpick factory. Like, who cares about a toothpick factory? But anyway, just growing up was a lot of fun and interesting. And, of course, you know, being a lesbian, it wasn't always easy.
Right.
But it was good. And, you know, I see the humor. I try to see the humor in almost everything, and I try to pass that on. And people tell me I'm a good storyteller. So...
And you have a story to share with us.
I do. I do. This is actually from early in the book. And it takes place since we're so close to Thanksgiving. I thought, well, let me do a Thanksgiving story.
Perfect.
So this takes place Thanksgiving morning, 1966. One of the first things that I learned as a little girl in the Roman Catholic family is that it's much better to be a little boy. Boys grow up to be men who make more little boys. Little girls grow up to be women who make lasagna. That wasn't something that I was told directly, of course, but only an idiot would miss the implication in conversations that went something like this. First Italian woman. Have you heard? Sal and Maria just had a baby girl, but they'll keep trying for a boy and get one, God willing. Second Italian woman. Perfect timing. Chopped beef is on sale. Another thing I learned is that the fathers of boys had, by virtue of having sons, accomplished the one and only thing they were put on earth to do. Not only were fathers of juniors considered ultra-virile, but also they'd assured the continuation of their names, first name and, more important, last. So on Thanksgiving morning in 1966, as I watched my father scrape a dead muskrat off the back lawn, I asked him to start calling me Mike. It was a win-win situation for both of us, I thought. Mike is Kim spelled backwards, I told him. He slid a shovel under the largest piece of the animal. Not exactly. Close enough, I assured. You don't like your name, he asked. I like Mike better, I told him. But your mother loves the name we gave you, he reminded me. I know, but it can be a nickname, I reasoned. It's a nice nickname. He launched a thick chunk of carcass off his shovel and into the air. It landed in the center of his garden. Then he tried to change the subject. Grab that other shovel and dig a hole for that thing, he said. I didn't move. I didn't want to dig a hole. Since when? You dig holes all the time, he reminded me, even when I don't ask you to. Mom said I'm not supposed to get dirty before company comes, I said. Do it neatly, he advised. I picked the shovel up off the ground. If you call me Mike, I'll help you more, I reasoned. You help me plenty, he said. My mother came out the back door then, balancing a large turkey on a rotisserie. She was a pretty woman with a tower of reddish-brown hair that was held in place at that moment by at least 20 long black bobby pins and an equally tall wall of folded paper towels. Midget, our oft-impregnated poodle, followed close behind her. The dog's nipples dragged on the cement porch. Go away, shoo! She pushed the dog with her left foot. Pat, call Midget before I trip over her, she said. My mother talked fast and almost always moved quickly, like she was being chased or late for an appointment. My father ignored her. He knew that the dog wouldn't come to him if he called. Midget hated everyone except my mother. This is much heavier than it looks, she said of the turkey as she struggled to slip the rotisserie into the slots on the grill. The bird looked like it had been in a horrible skiing accident. A culinary testament to my mother's first aid skills, it was bandaged tightly in cheesecloth from what was left of its neck all the way down to its rump. Its legs and wings poked out from each side, dripping melted butter and olive oil onto the hot coals. in a cab. They drove him away. Oh.
The big break.
Yeah. It was it's funny and it's spooky at the same time for a kid.
Sure.
You know,
we were
you know, everything was playtime and scary. Let's make stories and go to the musical rock. And, you know, we were being kids.
That's great. So when do you think you'll be finished with the book?
I'm shooting for the spring.
Yeah.
And we'll take it from there. I'm actually thinking of doing e-publishing this time.
Oh, yeah.
This time around.
Oh.
So I don't know. I have to do some research to see how long that takes and how I actually have to do that.
Sure.
If I can do it or, you know, how it works. So I'm shooting for spring.
Great.
It'll probably be more like fall. But Cork Tees is taking a lot of my time.
Right.
So
give us the website one more time.
CorkTees.net.
Good, good. Come back and talk to us again.
I would love to. Thank you so much.
Great.
This has been
a lot of fun.
And
happy holidays.
Same to you.
And that's our show this week. Thanks for joining us, and thanks to Scott O'Brien and Kim Fissera for joining us tonight, and thank you all out there for listening as well. Next week, Outbeat Now with Jeff Basham and Greg Moralia. Jeff will talk about supporting LGBT-friendly businesses while holiday shopping, and Greg will chat with members of UC Berkeley's LGBT fraternity. Gary and I will return with Outbeat Collage Sunday, December 19th. We'll interview photographer Michaela Kennan and give you some advice about how to wrap up your holiday shopping while supporting local LGBT artists. I'm Mark Prell.
I'm Gary Carnevale.
And this is Outbeat Collage, out in the arts. Happy Thanksgiving, everyone. But if you want to